two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Loudmouth Project Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee along with Amy Donaldson. And today we're joined by Neelam Chand. She is the founder and CEO of Shift SLC. It's a diversity and inclusion consulting firm here in Salt Lake City. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, you know, I wanted to have you on because for me, one of the things, I read an article you wrote in Utah Business. And essentially it was talking about kind of the momentum that had been gained from some of the activism that had gone over this summer. And I want you to kind of explain a little bit more about that. But how is it that you came to write this particular article?
Yeah, because as my role as a diversity and inclusion consultant, I talk to several different organizations across the nation. And we talk a lot about how to really bolster diversity and inclusion within the organization. And what I've noticed is during the summer of 2020, I've noticed that a lot of organizations wanted to really talk about racial justice and what that would look like. They wanted anti-racism trainings. They wanted to hire a chief diversity officer or have a few folks really kind of activate diversity and inclusion within their organization. They started employee resource groups that really focused on different cultural aspects of different identities. And so all of this happened, and then it sort of died down. And I've realized that in my conversations with, you know, different CEOs and organization leaders, where it's no longer about racial justice, it's more about how do we do diversity and inclusion work at the lowest cost possible. And to say that we've done it. And I don't think all organizations are doing that, but the organizations that really just wanted to do anti-racism work for the summer, sort of taken anti-racism work and put it in their back seat and really started to focus on other parts of the business. And so I wrote this article as a kind of a wake-up call, but also a call to action to not let anti-racism work fall back, to not be silent about anti-racism work, because it is something that needs to continuously be practiced, not just for a moment, but for the longevity of your business from start to finish. Because the moment that you lose that momentum is the moment that you are showing that you don't actually care about this work, not in a very authentic or genuine way.
So when you were talking to organizations, what was it that you saw? That was it fatigue? Was it not understanding that this was like this is a lifetime practice? I mean, it's sort of like the old adage, life is not cured, it's managed. And I would say that probably applies to anti-racism, that the work is constant. I mean, it's a lifelong endeavor to undo, you know, this. And so I guess I wonder what you saw or what you heard was the reason for sort of falling away from some of these ideals.
So the organizations that have sort of fell silent on anti-racism are the organizations that really were in crisis management mode. So during the summer, after the death of or the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, a lot and many others before, a lot of organizations had employees that were fed up, Black, Indigenous, people of color employees that were fed up and were, you know, really demanding more from their leadership. And so leaders, instead of actually acknowledging that they may be part of the problem, it was more of how do we fix this and how do we fix this quickly so that our employees can really just move on so we can get back to business. And those organizations, you know, either did a one-off anti-racism training or maybe they did a whole bunch of listening tours where they listened to their employees and then kind of fell off the map, but they felt like they did their job and then they moved on. And so I think it's the crisis management piece. It's no longer a crisis, so we can move on and move on to other things. We don't need to focus on anti-racism because no one's bringing it up anymore. So I think that was really the biggest issue that we're facing, that we're seeing organizations kind of moving away from anti-racism work into day-to-day business because it's no longer a crisis.
The name of the article is "Now That Protests Are Over, Companies Are Going Back to Business as Usual," and it was published in the January 5th issue of Utah Business. And you know, when I read it, I thought to myself, this is kind of what happens so often with, at least to me in my experience in the half a century I've been alive, is that race-related issues can dissipate if momentum isn't maintained over an extended period of time. And so, when the protests were continuing this summer, then you kept hearing about it. You kept hearing these efforts that companies and corporations were trying to implement because they saw the legitimacy of the issue, and they thought to themselves, well, this is how we can support it. But as time went on, there were fewer protests. Other things became equally as important, and then eventually kind of overrode it, especially when we got into the political season. So they took their eye off the ball, and they thought, well, obviously it's not that important anymore. We should move on to something else. What do you do to help people understand, and employers and other kinds of institutions to understand that it's important to maintain that momentum so that we can really, really move the needle and have progress so that we do have diversity, so that we do have inclusion, we do have equality?
Yeah, and it really, and I wrote this in my article, but it really starts at the leadership level. So I personally, what I try to do is I try to work with leaders to get them to a place where they can have a better understanding of their role in anti-racism work and in their role in racism in general, how they contribute, how their ideologies and behaviors may uphold racist ideologies. And so I think when leaders go through a personal journey and they, and not all folks, and if you think about who our leaders are in these organizations, especially in corporate America, they're majority white male. And not all of them will have this come to this realization that they are part of the systems that uphold racism. But for those who do, for those who actually take some personal accountability in racism, those are the organizations that then interweave anti-racism work within the DNA of their organization. And when we get to that point, then we get to the point where we just practice the muscle. We practice the muscle of anti-racism because it is every part of what the organization does. It's part of their business. It's part of their bottom line. It's part of their culture. It's part of the way that the organization thinks. But we don't get there until the leaders in these organizations get to a point where they have a personal understanding of what it means to be anti-racist and what it means for them on a very human personal level. Until then, it's just actions that are, you know, that are sporadic, again, based off of some sort of crisis.
Do you think that there were, I mean, the majority of people who tried to address issues that arose in the summer, sort of in the wake of the protests, do you think they actually did ever come to a true understanding of what's happening? Or do you think it was simply trying to placate or deal with an issue at, you know, amongst their employees?
I think for the organizations, and I'm telling you, there are some great organizations out there that are doing the work. And so when I wrote this article, I think there was this misconception that, you know, all organizations are, you know, are at this place where they are, where they just don't care. And that's not the case. Actually, quite a bit of organizations are in their very beginning journey of anti-racism work. But the organizations that just wanted to do performative allyship, which means basically to show the world that they care about these issues, whether it be through an ad or a social media post or a statement, those organizations that just did that and didn't do the actions that required of that was required of them to back up the statements, those were the organizations that really just did their one thing and then moved on to, you know, to business as usual. I think that those organizations are the ones that are suffering the most. Their employees within that organization is suffering the most. And I am seeing that. I am seeing employees, Black, Indigenous, people of color employees that are asking their questions of their leaders. What happened? You made a statement. You purchased an ad that said Black Lives Matter. What happened? Where's the follow-up? Why are we not talking about this anymore? And a lot of employees are being impacted by it.
When we come back, I want to continue this discussion and talk a little bit about as when we talk about leadership in these companies and in these corporations, how they can have a personal stake in making sure that happens. Because if you're a leader and you say to yourself, I want to make this part of the fabric of my company, then it'll happen. If you don't have that that accountability, if you don't have that drive and passion, then chances are it will just kind of go to the wayside when that momentum is lost. We're speaking today with Neelam Chan. She is founder and CEO of Shift SLC. That is a diversity and inclusion consulting firm. And I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson, and you're listening to Voices of Reason.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope in Darkness on kslpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Loud Mouth Project's Voices of Reason, along with Amy Donaldson. I'm Jason Lee. Today we're speaking with Neelam Chand, founder and CEO of Shift SLC, a diversity and inclusion consulting firm in Salt Lake City, of course. And we started off talking about an article that she wrote in Utah Business entitled, Now That the Protests Are Over, Companies Are Going Back to Business as Usual. And you kind of spoke about how what kind of transpires as there is this big push, this big awakening. But then over time, it literally momentum kind of dissipates. And where do we go from then? And how do you prevent those kinds of things from happening? But Amy was mentioning, what are some concrete things that you can suggest to some of these companies and some of these institutions that will help, you know, actually continue the progress that could potentially be made if a concerted effort is actually undertaken to have diversity and have inclusion?
Yeah, I would say the first thing that organizations can do is acknowledge. Acknowledgement of that racism exists. And the acknowledgement of white supremacy and how white supremacy can play out within a workplace setting. I know that the word white supremacy can really rattle folks because when people think about white supremacy, they think about, you know, KKK or, you know, these groups that are, you know, that are promoting racism in a very visceral way. But white supremacy is really, it permeates systems. It permeates our day-to-day culture. And so when you can acknowledge as a leader acknowledge that the foundations of our organization is laid on the work of white supremacy, or that racism actually exists within the organization, that then you're actually opening up doors to dismantle and really tackle the issues of racism. So acknowledging is the first thing. And then secondly, conveying to your organization, taking a clear position of anti-racism within your organization. That means that anything that is remotely close to racism within the organization or racial discrimination will not be tolerated within the organization. So to say that and to have that conveyed in your policies is one of the most important things that you could do. Then you can really start to get into, okay, how does racism show up in our policies, in our practices, in our procedures? What does that actually look like? How do we support racism in our culture? And it's really taking that lens and looking at every part of your organization through the lens of anti-racism. And I think those are the biggest ways. And then from there, you can start to attach anti-racism work within the way you do business. So holding yourself as leaders accountable and holding employees accountable to that, whether that be attaching it to metrics or attaching it to objectives or goals for the organization in terms of business. I think those are tangible ways of really understanding and really putting into action anti-racism work. Those are fairly simple. They're not things that take years and years and years. Jason and I were talking just before this, and we're saying that these things, yes, anti-racism work takes it's a long time. It could take lifetimes of really doing this work. But these tangibles are low-hanging fruits. They're things that can happen within a year.
Yeah, but you just said, I think the key that I think is not the case for most businesses and most people who are not aware, or who before these protests, or before, I think it was really George Floyd was the pivotal killing, that 8 minutes and 46 seconds just was so difficult to look away from, that I think that was really what sort of started making people who had not acknowledged racism in businesses or in daily life sort of take a look at it. But I think in my conversations, I think we don't have a lot of people, white businesses, white-owned businesses that are really willing to acknowledge the pervasiveness, the depth, the reality, really. And so I wonder if you're in an organization where you know you're never going to get the kind of buy-in that you've just talked about, which would be amazing. What could you do? Can you do anything?
If you're a person within an organization that where leaders, and you have predominantly white leaders who don't believe in this work, then it is really up to you on whether you want to stay in that organization. And I say that it's a kind of a harsh reality. And I say that because it isn't up to you as employees. An example is I was consulting an organization where majority of their employees felt that racism existed through racial microaggressions, which are sort of subtle racial discriminations that happen on a day-to-day basis. And so we did a survey to kind of find out, the sentiments across the board in terms of culture of the organization. And a lot of the employees, specifically employees of color, felt that the organization did not foster a workplace that is anti-racist. Whereas on the leadership, when we did the same survey, the leaders ignored the fact that racism even existed. They felt that their organization was perfectly fine. They were sort of in the state of denial where their organization was great the way it is. And no leader wants to align with an organization that they represent that's remotely close to being racist. So there's a big disconnect between employees and leaders. And when leaders do not shift their mentality or their mindset around this work, then employees don't have the power to actually work upstream to change the minds of their leaders. They can try, but that's an emotionally taxing really emotionally taxing project to take on. So it's really up to you as an employee, whether you want to align with that organization, whether you want to stay within that organization or not. And I know that's really tough because there's really not a great answer to that question, but it truly just means that the power lies in leadership. And if they are not willing to move the needle, then it's not your responsibility as an employee.
You know, when I look at this, the thing that kind of troubles me, and this is kind of to the point we talked about before, if your leadership doesn't recognize their own blind spot, then they won't have any reason to feel like they need to change. And then you have to somehow convince them that they have this blind spot when being called a racist to many, majority people is one of the worst things, if not the worst thing you can say to them. And certainly when they don't feel that this is true. And I don't know if there even is a way to overcome that when their first reaction is to defend themselves rather than to accept, say, hey, well, maybe there's some legitimacy to what's being said here, and rather than taking it personally, maybe I can do some, look inwardly and determine if in fact there is some truth to it.
And I think the biggest thing is really normalizing the concept of racism and normalizing that we all carry and contribute to racist ideologies. Every single one of us, me as a person of color, I had to do a lot of soul searching to really understand the way I show up and how I uphold racist ideologies, even as a person of color. And so I think just normalizing the word racism and normalizing that we all carry racist ideologies. Then now that doesn't absolve the roles that white women play in racism. But what that does do is that each one of us have to take time introspectively understand how we contribute to racism. And I think if we can normalize it, then the conversation can be a little bit easier. Not super easy. Doesn't make it smooth sailing, but it does make it a little bit easier.
We're joined today by Neelam Chan. She is the founder and CEO of Shift SLC, a diversity and inclusion consulting firm, and she's trying to enlighten us on how business and just institutions in general can make their entities better by being more aware of the potential racism that exists and what they can do to actually improve the situation so that, you know, it doesn't exist, at least in the forms that it has been. Along with Amy Donaldson, I'm Jason Lee. You're listening to The Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. Welcome back to The Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today we're joined by Neelam Chan, founder and CEO of Shift SLC, a diversity and inclusion consulting firm in Utah. And when we were speaking offline, Neelam, you mentioned that one of the things that is of interest to you is how companies, how they use their brand ID to kind of promote, obviously, themselves, but how is it that the institutional idea of racism might factor into how they identify?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that Edelman, a communications firm, a large communications firm, came out with a special sort of report. This was during the summer of 2020. And they came out with a report where they surveyed a bunch of young folks, millennials and Gen Zs, on sort of the types of brands that they support. And what they found in this survey is that 60% of the folks that were surveyed said that they support brands that aligned with racial justice, and they will only support brands that align with racial justice. And those same 60% also felt that brands need to not only align with social justice, but they actually have a role to educate and influence on racial justice work. So they're not just brands that sell services or products, that they are actual folks that influence our society towards racial justice. And I think that's profound to look at because we, as you know, when we think about the corporate world and the corporate's responsibility in making change in our society, this report just tells you how our young folks are thinking. And our young folks, we're not in a day and age where young people are silent. They turn to Twitter, they turn to all the social media platforms to really hold these organizations accountable. So if you don't align with racial justice, if you're not doing your part in our society to promote racial justice, to promote anti-racism work, you're going to be under scrutiny. Young folks are going to call you out, and they're going to also question whether they want to invest in you or your brand. And I think that's huge. I think that's really important. But I also say this because I don't want companies and organizational leaders to tell a story that they support racial justice, where in fact, their actions, their policies, their systems don't actually align with that support, with those statements. And so there's a balance there. And so if you want to get to a point where you can tell folks, where you can tell young folks that we are a brand that you can trust, we are a brand that want to make change in our society, we are a brand that actually has opinions in politics, that politics actually plays a role in our services and our products. Until you get to that point, then I wouldn't make those proclamations. But I think it's very important to head that direction because of our young people and how our young people are holding companies accountable.
Can you give me some other insights? I mean, I had two thoughts. The first one is when you're talking to employers about anti-racism, how do you handle it when you run into somebody who takes things personally? I mean, like when you talk white supremacy and they think you're saying they're white supremacist, right? And also, how do you handle it when you're describing or discussing a racist incident or racism, institutional racism, and it's not, Jason knows I have described things like this before, it's not racist enough for somebody to see it as racist. So, you know, I mean, it's definitely racist, but there are some people who, unless it's like wearing a white hood and saying the N-word, it's not racist enough. So with those two scenarios, I wonder if you've run into them when you work with corporate leaders and what you would advise.
Absolutely. Those have happened several different times. When we talk about racism, it's a personal issue. And so I think when I deal with folks who feel very personal, when they feel personally attacked, I think it's a little tough to navigate those waters because, again, my job is to help change attitudes and mindsets so that behaviors can change. But when those attitudes and mindsets are sort of stuck and don't necessarily want to face sort of where they're at, how they contribute to racism, I have to decipher and kind of back to the question, what do employees do when their leaders don't acknowledge racism? I kind of have to decipher whether that person who is so against this work or who feels very personally attacked, whether I want to continue engaging, because I think where the change happens, where transformation happens, is where folks, they're going to feel personally attacked. They're going to feel uncomfortable when we talk about racism and white privilege and we use those words and we use the words white supremacy. People are going to feel uncomfortable, and I think that's fine. But to the point where people feel closed off, those are the folks that are not going to help move the needle towards change. And what I found is majority of the folks are actually in the middle. These folks are apprehensive to have the conversation because there's a lot of fear in what they're going to say, and they're worried about the mistakes that they're going to make. But I think they're willing to change. They're open to the conversation. But the moment that the words like white supremacy and racism shuts them off and they're not willing to engage, that's kind of on them. And so I kind of leave those conversations and I try to find other ways to make change. So for those who feel like the overt racism only lives in these overt, large ways, whether it be in the media, on the news, in movies, in our history, I usually talk to them about those subtle ways that it shows up. And so racism doesn't need to be this big production. It's not always a group of KKK or white supremacists marching or attacking our Capitol for that matter. It can show up in a workplace setting day in, day out, in just interpersonal relationships, in conversation. And I think drawing out what those mean and what those look like is really, really important. And there's several different examples of what that can look like. But I think that for leaders, it's really understanding what those situations are to come to that realization.
I know as a person who's worked in professional environments, you know, all my life, I've oftentimes, and at least for the last 20 years, been the only African-American person in my newsroom. And that's whether I was on radio or in print or online. And so, you know, even though people don't think of themselves as biased, by being in a homogenous environment day in and day out, it just lends itself to you having a lack of understanding, which could then lead to behavior that is unwittingly biased and continues to perpetuate stereotypic responses and lack of understanding. And until people can recognize that as being part of the racism issue, then it'll be, again, it's a long slog, but it just takes some recognition and some just acquiescence to the idea that I have some bias, but I need to learn how to identify it and then learn how to change that behavior so that the environment that I work in and the people who work in here also have a better situation to come to. We're speaking today with Neelam Chan, founder and CEO of Shift SLC, a diversity and inclusion consulting firm. Along with Amy Donaldson, I'm Jason Lee. This is the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, joined by Neelam Chan, founder and CEO of Shift SLC. She's been talking to us about how, in a generally speaking, a company or a professional environments or work environments, how people can make change. And this is kind of based on an article she wrote called "Now That the Protests Are Over, Companies Are Going Back to Business as Usual." Whereas earlier on in the summer, there was this big push to work on diversity, work on inclusion, try to be an ally to those people of color who are being negatively impacted by workplace and just societal bias. But as time goes on, that momentum kind of waned, and now we're at a situation where people have just gone back to the way it used to be, as much as they can under this COVID environment. But I wanted to ask you, Neelam, in this situation that we find ourselves in now, where we don't have the momentum that we used to, where do we go from here to try to reclaim some of that positive momentum, some of that positive energy, so that we can actually make some change in the years ahead?
Well, I think the biggest thing for us is to continuously talk about racism and continuously talking about anti-racism in the workplace, to not ever go silent. And I don't think we need to have these conversations when there's a crisis. I mean, I think that's important, but I think that that's not the only time. I think we need to make it continuous, where it's a part of our day in and day out, where leaders are constantly starting off meetings talking about racism, and maybe in the most subtle ways. But I think keeping the conversation going, I think that's important, because now it's part of your culture. And when we engage in those conversations, we are validating the employees. When we think about in a workplace setting, we're invalidating the Black, Indigenous, and people of color employees and their experiences on a consistent basis, not when we see the news, not when something happens outside of the organization. It really truly becomes an everyday practice. I think that's so important. And then the other piece of it is really doing personal work. I think when we all really understand the way we show up and the way we uphold racism and racist ideologies, beyond reading, you know, How to Be an Anti-Racist and beyond reading White Privilege, reading these books that are out, but really truly understanding our own roles and looking back to our upbringing, looking back into our own biases. If we really take a moment to do the work, we can change. We can change a whole organization. We can change a whole culture. But it really takes us, you know, really activating our allyship beyond reading books and articles and watching a documentary on racism. So I think that is just really becoming introspective and taking the time to do the work really will have some positive change. And it's not easy. It's going to take some time. There's going to be some harsh realities, but if we're willing to do that, then we will see change. I'm positive of that.
So let me ask you a question. I just read an article a couple of weeks ago about how most of the job losses in the last quarter were almost exclusively women of color. So there were fewer job losses than expected. Jason knows these numbers better than me because that's his assigned beat. But I have heard so little about that. And I just think the value we place on certain jobs and certain people maybe it's media, but I think in society in general. And so I feel sometimes very hopeless about having those conversations because I just feel like I feel like I've been having the same conversations for 30 years, really. And I don't know, like, where do you get the energy to just be, you know, and I just keep telling myself, well, you have privilege. So you think you're tired, you know, think about being one of the people who had their job eliminated. but I just wonder about, you know, the media's responsibility in this and how can we shift? How can we have more voices, that just make this part of everyday life, not this one-off story about, you know, a single issue or a single incident?
Yeah, I think representation is so important and making sure that many stories, many voices are being heard. And it's interesting you bring up women of color, because when I think about in my article, I write about the emotional tax that Black, Indigenous, and people of color employees face in the workplace where they feel on guard on a day-to-day basis. And part of the emotional tax that really impact people of color impact women of color the most, and more specifically Black and Latinx women the most. And I think it's because there is this intersection of gender and race that plays a big part of a woman of color's identity and in sort of navigating these waters. But no one really no one really talks about those experiences, not on a mainstream platform. So I think it is important for storytellers to really create those platforms, to really create spaces where the most marginalized folks in a workplace setting and in our society in general have a voice and are able to talk about their experiences in these spaces. Otherwise, we're just sort of oblivious. We're not really learning from each other, and we're not addressing the issues that are largely impacting the most vulnerable populations. And so I think that there is a big responsibility in storytellers and the media to make space for the voices that are not mainstream, the voices that are not consistently heard.
You know, when we started talking, you and I just offline, it's just the recognition that people have to have for themselves, that they can be part of the solution, but they also have to recognize they've been part of the problem. And just because you've had that experience and that you exhibited that behavior in the past doesn't necessarily mean it has to continue. I often think that if we were to just look inside, I had to be awakened to my own misogyny. It's not something I was proud of, but it was also something I wasn't doing necessarily intentionally, at least not consciously. So if I'm able to look in the mirror and say, okay, these are shortcomings I have, but if I work to correct them, then I'm better. And the people who I influence and who engage with me, they're better for it as well. So it just takes a little bit of I don't know, a little courage. But to be honest with you, just enough determination to say, you know what, I'm not going to take it so personally that I can't do better. Because
And I also think if we took it less personally and just said, like, we were just, this our culture is steeped in white supremacy and sexism. And so what choice do we really have? But we were baked in that pie, right? So now we have to figure it out and unravel it. And so it's not necessarily choices you made. At some point, they become your choices. But it's sometimes just the way we were indoctrinated or, you know, the way we were raised, the way we were taught.
Right. And, you know, but that's okay because we can overcome that too. Listen, I want to say thank you to Neelam Chand, founder and CEO of Shift SLC, the diversity and inclusion firm here in Salt Lake City. Join us again for the next episode of the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. And if you have any comments about our show, please contact us via email at voramed@gmail.com or at vorjasonl@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter and at adonsports and at jasonlee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VORpodcast. Check out our Facebook page, and you can also find and subscribe to free episodes of our podcast in all the places where you might find interesting content. Be sure to review our show as well. We love to get your feedback, and it helps us grow our audience. Until next time, along with Amy Donaldson, I'm Jason Lee. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason. Voices of Reason is a production of the Loudmouth Project.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.